I want to know.
Oh, thanks, I say. He sits on his cot and looks at me for a long time.
So, what's the story with you and August, anyway?
What do you mean?
Are you guys tight, or what?
I haul my body into a sitting position and lean against the wall. I hate the bastard, I say finally.
Ha! Walter snorts. Okay, so you do have some sense. So why do you spend all your time with them?
I don't answer.
Oh, sorry. I forgot.
You've got it all wrong, I say, hauling myself upright.
Yeah?
He's my boss, and I have no choice.
That's true. But it's also about the woman, and you know it.
I raise my head and glare at him.
Okay, okay, he says, raising his hands in surrender. I'll shut up. You know the score.
He turns and rummages in his crate.
Here,
he says, tossing me an 8-pager. It skids across the floor and stops beside me.
It's not Marlena, but it's better than nothing.
After he turns away, I pick it up and thumb through it. But despite the explicit and exaggerated drawings, I can't muster any interest whatever in Mr. Big Studio Director boning the skinny would-be starlet with the horse face.
Chapter 13.
I blink rapidly, trying to get my bearings. That skinny nurse with the horse face has dropped a tray of food at the end of the hall, and it's woken me up. I wasn't aware of dozing, but that's how it goes these days. I seem to slip in and out of time and space. Either I'm finally going senile, or else it's my mind's way of coping with being entirely unchallenged in the present. The nurse crouches down, collecting the spilled food. I don't like her. She's the one who's always trying to keep me from walking. I think I'm just too wobbly for her nerves, because even Dr. Rashid admits that walking is good for me as long as I don't overdo it or get stranded. I'm parked in the hallway just outside my door. But it's still several hours before my family comes, and I think I'd like to look out the window. I could just call the nurse, but what fun would that be? I shift my bottom to the edge of my wheelchair and reach for my walker. 1, 2, 3. Her pale face thrusts itself in front of mine. Can I help you, Mr. Jankowski? That was almost too easy. Why, I'm just going to look out the window for a while, I say, feigning surprise. Why don't you sit tight and let me take you, she says, planting both hands firmly on the arms of my chair. Oh, well then, yes. That's very kind of you, I say. I lean back in my seat, lift my feet onto the footrests, and fold my hands in my lap. The nurse looks puzzled. Dear Lord, that's an impressive overbite. She straightens up and waits, I guess to see if I'm going to make a run for it. I smile pleasantly and train my gaze on the window at the end of the hall. Finally, she goes behind me and takes the handles of my wheelchair. Well, I must say, Mr. Jankowski, I'm a little surprised. You're normally, rather adamant about walking. Oh, I could have made it. I'm only letting you push me because there aren't any chairs by the window. Why is that, anyway? Because there's nothing to see, Mr. Jankowski. There's a circus to see. Well, this weekend, maybe. But normally there's just a parking lot. What if I want to look at a parking lot? Then you shall, Mr. Jankowski, she says, pushing me up to the window. My brow furrows. She was supposed to argue with me. Why didn't she argue with me? Oh, but I know why. She thinks I'm just an addled old man. Don't upset the residents, oh no. Especially not that old Jankowski fellow. He'll fling pockmarked jello at you and then call it an accident. She starts to walk away. Hey! I call after her. I haven't got my walker. Just call me when you're ready, she says. I'll come get you. No, I want my walker. I always have my walker. Get me my walker. Mr. Jankowski, says the girl. She folds her arms and sighs deeply. Rosemary appears from a side hall like an angel from heaven. Is there a problem? She says, looking from me to the horse-faced girl and then back again. I want my walker and she won't get it, I say. I didn't say I wouldn't. All I said was... Rosemary holds up a hand. Mr. Jankowski likes to have his walker beside him. He always does. If he asks for it, please bring it. But nothing. Get his walker. Outrage flashes across the horse girl's face, replaced almost instantly by hostile resignation. She throws a murderous glance my direction and goes back for my walker. She holds it conspicuously in front of her, storming down the hall. When she reaches me, she slams it in front of me. Which would be more impressive if it didn't have rubber leg caps, making it land with a squeak rather than a bang. I smirk. I can't help it. She stands there, arms akimbo, staring at me, waiting for a thank you, no doubt. I turn my head slowly, chin raised like an Egyptian pharaoh, training my gaze on the magenta and white striped big top. I find the stripes jarring. In my day, only the concession stands were striped. The big top was plain white, or at least started out that way. By the end of the season, it may have been streaked with mud and grass, but it was never striped. And that's not the only difference between this show and the shows from my past. This one doesn't even have a midway, just a big top with a ticket gate at the door and concession and souvenir stand beside it. It looks like they still sell the same old fare. Popcorn, candy, and balloons. But the children also carry flashing swords and other moving, blinking toys I can't make out at this distance. Bet their parents paid an arm and a leg for them, too. Some things never change. Rubes are still rubes, and you can still tell the performers from the workers. Mr. Jankowski? Rosemary is leaning over me, seeking my eyes with hers. Huh? Are you ready for lunch, Mr. Jankowski? She says. It can't be lunchtime. I only just got here. She looks at her watch. A real one with arms. Those digital ones came and went, thank God. When will people learn that just because you can make something doesn't mean you should? It's 11:58, she says. Oh, all right then. What day is it anyway? Why, it's Sunday, Mr. Jankowski, the Lord's Day, the day your people come. I know that. I meant, what's for lunch? Nothing you'll like, I'm sure, she says. I raise my head, prepared to be angry. Oh, come now, Mr. Jankowski, she says, laughing. I was only joking. I know that, I say. What, now I have no sense of humor? But I'm grumpy, because maybe I don't. I don't know anymore. I'm so used to being scolded and herded and managed and handled that I'm no longer sure how to react when somebody treats me like a real person. Rosemary tries to steer me toward my usual table, but I'm having none of that. Not with old Fart McGinty there. He's wearing his clown hat again. Must have asked the nurses to put it on him again first thing this morning. The damn fool. Or maybe he slept in it. And he's still got helium balloons tied to the back of his chair. They're not really floating anymore, though. They're starting to pucker, hovering above limp lengths of string. When Rosemary turns my chair toward him, I bark, Oh, no, you don't. There, over there. I point at an empty table in the corner. It's the one farthest from my usual table. I just hope it's out of earshot. Oh, come now, Mr. Jankowski, Rosemary says. She stops my chair and comes around to face me. You can't keep this up forever. I don't see why not. Forever might be next week for me. She puts her hands on her hips. Do you even remember why you're so angry? Yes, I do, because he's lying. Are you talking about the elephants again? I purse my lips by way of an answer. He doesn't see it that way, you know. That's cockamamie. When you're lying, you're lying. He's an old man, she says. He's 10 years younger than me, I say, straightening up indignantly. Oh, Mr. Jankowski, Rosemary says. She sighs and gazes toward heaven as though asking for help. Then she crouches in front of my chair and places her hand on mine. I thought you and I had an understanding. I frown. This is not part of the usual Nurse Jacob repertoire. He may be wrong in the details, but he's not lying, she says. He really believes that he carried water for the elephants. He does. I don't answer. Sometimes when you get older, and I'm not talking about you, I'm talking generally, because everyone ages differently, things you think on and wish on start to seem real. And then you believe them. And before you know it, they're a part of your history. And if someone challenges you on them and says they're not true, why, then you get offended. Because you don't remember the first part. All you know is that you've been called a liar. So even if you're right about the technical details, can you understand why Mr. McGinty might be upset? I scowl into my lap. Mr. Jankowski, she continues softly, let me take you to the table with your friends. Go on now, as a favor to me. Well, isn't that just dandy? The first time in years a woman wants a favor from me, and I can't stomach the idea. Mr. Jankowski, I look up at her. Her smooth face is 2 feet from mine. She looks me in the eye, waiting for an answer. Oh, all right. But don't expect me to talk to anyone, I say, waving a hand in disgust. And I don't. I sit and listen as old liar McGinty talks about the wonders of the circus and his experiences as a boy, and I watch as the blue-haired old ladies lean toward him and listen, their eyes growing misty with admiration. It drives me completely berserk. Just as I open my mouth to say something, I catch sight of Rosemary. She's on the opposite end of the room, bending over an old woman and tucking a napkin into her collar. But her eyes are on me. I close my mouth again. I just hope she appreciates how hard I'm trying. She does. When she comes to retrieve me, after the tan-colored pudding with edible oil product topping has made its appearance, sat for a while, and been removed, she leans down and whispers, I knew you could do it, Mr. Jankowski. I just knew it. Yes. Well, it wasn't easy. But it's better than sitting alone at a table, isn't it? Maybe. She rolls her eyes toward heaven again. All right, yes, I say grudgingly. I suppose it's better than sitting alone.
Chapter 14.
It's been 6 days since Marlena's accident, and she has yet to reappear. August no longer comes to the cookhouse for meals, so I sit conspicuously alone at our table. When I run across him in the course of looking after the animals, he's polite but distant. For her part, Rosie is carted out through each town in the hippopotamus wagon and then displayed in the menagerie. She has learned to follow August from the elephant car to the menagerie tent, and in return for this, he has stopped beating the hell out of her. Instead, she trudges alongside him, and he walks with the bull hooks snagged firmly in the flesh behind her front leg. Once in the menagerie, she stands behind her rope, happily charming the crowds and accepting candy. Uncle Al hasn't actually said so, but there don't appear to be any immediate plans to attempt another elephant act. As the days pass, I grow more anxious about Marlena. Each time I approach the cookhouse, I hope that I'll find her there, and each time I don't, my heart sinks. It's the end of another long day in some damn city or other. They all look about the same from a railroad siding. And the flying squadron is preparing to pull out. I'm lounging on my bedroll reading Othello, and Walter is on his cot reading Wordsworth. Queenie is tucked up against him. She lifts her head and growls. Both Walter and I jerk upright. Earl's large bald head pokes around the edge of the doorframe.
Doc,
he says, looking at me.
Hey, Doc.
Hi, Earl. What's up?
I need your help.
Sure, what is it? I say, putting my book down. I shoot a glance at Walter, who is pinned to the squirming Queenie against his side. She's still grumbling.
It's Campbell,
he says in a hushed voice.
He's got trouble.
What kind of trouble?
Foot trouble. They've gone all floppy. He kind of slaps them down. His hands aren't so great neither.
Is he drunk?
Not at this particular moment. But it don't make no difference, nohow.
Well, damn, Earl, I say. He's got to see a doctor. Earl's forehead crinkles.
Well, yeah. That's why I'm here.
Earl, I'm no doctor.
You're an animal doctor.
It's not the same. I glance at Walter, who's pretending to read. Earl blinks expectantly at me. Look, I say finally, if he's in bad shape, let me talk to August or Uncle Al and see if we can get a doctor out in Dubuque.
They won't get him a doctor.
Why not? Earl straightens in righteous indignation.
Damn. You don't know nothing at all, do you?
If there's something seriously wrong with him, surely they'll...
Throw him off the train is what,
says Earl definitively.
Now, if he was one of the animals.
I ponder this for only a moment before realizing he's right. Okay, I'll arrange for a doctor myself.
How? You got money?
Well, no, I say, embarrassed. Does he?
If he had any money, do you think he'd be drinking Jake and canned heat? Oh, come on. Won't you at least have a look? The old feller went out of his way to help you.
I know that, Earl. I know that, I say quickly. But I don't know what you expect me to do.
You're the doctor. Just have a look.
In the distance, a whistle blows.
Come on,
says Earl.
That's the 5-minute whistle. We gotta move.
I follow him to the car that carries the big top. The wedge horses are already in place, and all over the flying squadron, men are lifting ramps, climbing aboard, and sliding doors shut.
Hey, Camel!
Earl shouts into the open door.
I brought the doc.
Jacob,
croaks a voice from inside. I jump up. It takes me a moment to adjust to the darkness. When I do, I make out Camel's figure in the corner, huddled on a pile of feed sacks. I walk over and kneel down. What's up, Camel?
I don't rightly know, Jacob. I woke up a few days ago, and my feet was all floppy. Just can't feel them right.
Can you walk?
A bit. But I have to lift my knees real high, because my feet are so floppy.
His voice drops to a whisper.
It just ain't that, though, he says. It's other stuff, too.
What other stuff? His eyes grow wide and fearful.
Man stuff. I can't feel nothing. In front.
The train jolts forward, slowly, lurching as the couplings tighten.
We're pulling out. You gotta get off now,
says Earl, tapping me on the shoulder. He moves to the open door and waves me toward him. I'll ride this leg with you, I say.
You can't.
Why not?
Because someone'll hear you've been fraternizing with roustabouts and chuck you. Well, more likely these guys. Off this thing, he says.
Damn, Earl, aren't you security? Tell him he got lost.
I'm on the main train. This here's Blackie's territory, he says, waving with increasing urgency. Come on.
I look into Camel's eyes. They're fearful, pleading. I've got to go, I say. I'll catch up with you in Dubuque. You'll be okay. We'll get you to a doctor.
I ain't got no money.
It's okay. We'll find a way.
Come on,
shouts Earl. I lay a hand on the old man's shoulder. We'll figure something out, okay? Camel's rheumy eyes flicker. Okay? He nods, just once. I rise from my haunches and walk to the doorway. Damn, I say, gazing out on the fast-moving scenery. The train picked up speed faster than I thought.
And it ain't gonna get any slower,
says Earl, placing a hand square in the middle of my back and shoving me out the door. What the hell, I shout, flailing my arms like a windmill. I hit the gravel and roll onto my side. There's a thunk as another body hits behind me.
See?
Earl says, getting up and wiping off his backside.
I told you he was bad.
I stare in amazement.
What?
He says, looking baffled. Nothing, I say. I get up and brush the dust and gravel from my clothes.
Come on. You better get back before anyone sees you up here.
Just tell them I was checking out the baggage stock.
Oh, good one, yeah. Guess that's why you're the doc and I'm not, huh?
My head swivels, but his expression is completely without guile. I give up and start walking toward the main train.
What's the matter?
Earl calls after me.
Why are you shaking your head, Doc?
What was all that about?
Says Walter as I walk in the door. Nothing, I say.
Yeah, right. I was here for most of it. Spill the beans, Doc.
I hesitate. It's one of the guys from the flying squadron. He's in a bad way.
Well, that much was obvious. How did he seem to you?
Scared. And quite frankly, I don't blame him. I want to get him to a doctor, but I'm flat broke, and so is he.
He won't be for long. Tomorrow's payday. But what are his symptoms?
Loss of feeling in his legs and arms and, well, other stuff, too.
What other stuff?
I glance downward. You know.
Oh, shit,
says Walter. He sits upright.
That's what I thought. You don't need a doctor. He's got Jake leg.
He's got what?
Jake leg. Jake walk. Limber leg. Whatever, it's all the same thing.
Never heard of it.
Someone made a big batch of bad Jake. Put plasticizers in it or something. It went out all over the country. One bad bottle, and you're done for.
What do you mean, done for?
Paralyzed. It can start any time within 2 weeks of drinking the shit.
I'm horrified. How the hell do you know this? He shrugs.
It's in the papers. They only just figured out what it was, but there's lots been affected. Maybe tens of thousands, mostly in the South. We passed through there on our way up to Canada. Maybe that's where he picked up the Jake.
I pause before asking my next question. Can they fix it?
Nope.
They can't do anything at all.
I already told you, he's done for.
But if you want to waste your money on a doctor to tell you that, be my guest. Black and white fireworks explode across my field of vision. A shifting, shimmering pattern that blanks out everything else. I drop onto my bedroll.
Hey, you okay?
Says Walter.
Whoa, pal. You're looking a little green there. You're not going to throw up, are you?
No, I say. My heart pounds. Blood whooshes through my ears. I've just remembered the small bottle of brackish liquid Camel offered me my first day on the show. I'm okay. Thank God. The next day, right after breakfast, Walter and I line up in front of the red ticket wagon along with everyone else. At 9 on the nose, the man in the wagon beckons forth the first person, a roustabout. Moments later, he stalks off, cursing and spitting on the ground. The next one, another roustabout, also leaves in a fit of pique. The people in the line turn to each other, muttering behind their hands.
Uh-oh,
says Walter. What's going on?
It looks like he's holding back Uncle Al style.
What do you mean?
Most shows hold back some pay till the end of the season, but when Uncle Al runs out of money, he holds it all back.
Damn, I say as a third man storms off. Two other working men, grim-faced and with hand-rolled cigarettes between their lips, leave the lineup.
Why are we bothering, then? It only applies to working men, Walter says. Performers and bosses always get paid.
I'm neither of those. Walter regards me for a couple of seconds.
No, you're not. I don't actually know what the heck you are, but anyone who sits at the same table as the equestrian director is not a working man. That much I know.
So does this happen often?
Yep, says Walter.
He's bored, scuffing the ground with his foot.
Does he ever make it up to them? Don't think anyone's ever tested the theory. The general wisdom is that if he owes you more than 4 weeks' pay, you better stop showing up on payday.
Why? I say, watching as yet another filthy man stomps off in a maelstrom of curses.
Three other working men leave the line from in front of us. They head back to the train with stooped shoulders.
Basically, you don't want Uncle Al to start thinking of you as a financial liability. 'Cause if he does, you disappear one night.
What, you get red-lighted?
Damn right.
It seems a bit extreme. I mean, why not just leave them behind?
'Cause he owes the money. How well do you think that would go over?
I'm second in line now, behind Lottie. Her blonde hair gleams in the sun, arranged into neat finger curls. The man at the window of the red wagon waves her forward. They chat pleasantly as he peels a few bills off his stack. When he hands them to her, she licks her forefinger and counts them. Then she rolls them up and slips them inside the top of her dress.
Next.
I step forward.
Name,
says the man without looking up. He's a small, bald fellow with a fringe of thin hair and wire-rimmed glasses. He stares at the ledger book in front of him.
Jacob Jankowski, I say, peering past him.
The wagon's interior is lined with carved wood panels and a painted ceiling. There's a desk and a safe at the back and a sink along one wall. On the opposite wall is a map of the United States with colored pins stuck in it. Our route, presumably. The man runs his finger down the ledger. It comes to a stop, and then moves to the far right column.
Sorry, he says.
What do you mean, sorry? He looks up at me, the picture of sincerity.
Uncle Al doesn't like anyone to finish the season broke. He always holds back 4 weeks' pay.
You'll get it at the end of season.
Next!
But I need it now. He fixes his eyes upon me, his face implacable.
You'll get it at the end of season.
Next! As Walter approaches the open window, I stalk off, pausing just long enough to spit in the dust. The answer comes to me as I'm chopping fruit for the orangutan. It's a mental flash, a vision of a sign. Don't have money? What have you got? We'll take anything. I walk back and forth in front of car 48 at least 5 times before I finally climb inside and knock on the door of stateroom 3.
Who is it?
Says August.
It's me, Jacob.
There's a slight pause.
Come in,
he says. I open the door and step inside. August stands by one of the windows. Marlena is in one of the plush chairs, her bare feet resting on an ottoman.
Hi,
she says, blushing. She pulls her skirt over her knees and then smooths it across her thighs.
Hello, Marlena, I say. How are you?
Doing better.
I'm walking a bit now. Won't be long before I'm back in the saddle, as it were.
So what brings you here? August interjects. Not that we're not delighted to see you. We've missed you, haven't we, darling?
Yes, says Marlena.
She raises her eyes to mine, and I flush.
Oh, where are my manners? Would you like a drink?
Says August. His eyes are unnaturally hard, set above a stern mouth.
No, thank you.
I'm caught off guard by his hostility.
I can't stay. I just wanted to ask you something.
And what's that?
I need to arrange to get a doctor out here.
Why?
I hesitate. I'd rather not say.
Ah, he says, winking at me. I understand.
What? I say, horrified. No, it's nothing like that. I glance at Marlena, who turns quickly toward the window.
It's for a friend of mine. Yes, of course it is, says August, smiling.
No, it really is, and it's not. Look, I just wondered if you knew of anyone. Never mind. I'll walk into town and see what I can find. I turn to leave.
Jacob,
Marlena calls after me. I stop in the doorway, staring out the window across the narrow hall. I take a couple of breaths before turning to face her.
There's a doctor coming to see me in Davenport tomorrow, she says quietly. Shall I send for you when we're finished?
I'd be much obliged, I say. I tip my hat and leave. The next morning, the line in the cookhouse is buzzing. It's because of that damn bull, says the man in front of me. She can't do nothing anyway. Poor buggers, says his friend. It's a shame when a man's worth less than a beast.
Excuse me, I say. What do you mean it's because of the bull?
The first man stares at me. He's large across the shoulders, wearing a dirty brown jacket. His face is deeply creased, weathered and brown as a raisin. 'Cause she costs so much. Plus, they bought that elephant car. No, but what's because of her? A bunch of men went missing overnight. Six at least, maybe more.
What, from the train?
Yep. I set my half-full plate down on the steam table and walk toward the flying squadron. After a few strides, I break into a run.
Hey, pal, the man calls after me. You ain't even it yet.
Leave him alone, Jock, says his friend. He probably needs to lay eyes on someone.
Camel! Camel, you in there?
I stand in front of the train car, trying to see into its musty interior.
Camel, you in there?
There's no answer.
Camel!
Nothing. I spin around, facing the lot.
Shit!
I kick the gravel and then kick it again.
Shit!
Just then, I hear a mewling from inside the car.
Camel, is that you?
A muffled noise comes from one of the darkened corners. I hop inside. Camel is lying up against the far wall. He's passed out cold, holding an empty bottle. I lean over and pluck it from his hand. Lemon extract.
Who the hell are you and what the hell do you think you're doing? Says a voice from behind me.
I turn. It's Grady. He's standing on the ground in front of the open door, smoking a ready-made.
Oh, hey. Sorry, Jacob. Didn't recognize you from the back.
Hi, Grady, I say.
How's he been?
Kind of hard to tell, he answers.
He's been tight since last night.
Camel snorts and tries to roll over. His left arm flops limply across his chest. He smacks his lips and starts snoring. I'm getting a doctor out today, I say. Keep an eye on him in the meantime, will you?
Of course I will, says Grady, affronted.
What the hell do you think I am, Blackie? Who the hell do you think kept him safe last night?
Of course I don't think you're...
Ah, hell, just forget it. Look, if he sobers up, try to keep him that way, okay? I'll catch up with you later with the doctor. The doctor holds my father's pocket watch in his pudgy hand, turning it over and inspecting it through his pince-nez. He pops it open to examine the face.
Yes, this will do. So what is it then?
He says, slipping it into his vest pocket. We're in the hallway just outside August and Marlena's stateroom. The door is still open.
We need to go somewhere else, I say, lowering my voice.
The doctor shrugs.
Fine, let's go.
As soon as we're outside, the doctor turns to me.
So, where are we going to perform this examination?
It's not me, it's a friend of mine. He's having problems with his feet and hands. And other stuff. He'll tell you when we get there.
Ah, says the doctor. Mr. Rosenbluth led me to believe that you were having difficulties of a personal nature.
The doctor's expression changes as he follows me down the track.
By the time we leave the shiny painted cars of the first section behind,
He looks alarmed. By the time we reach the battered cars of the flying squadron, his face is pinched in disgust. He's in here, I say, hopping into the car.
And how, pray tell, am I supposed to get in? He says.
Earl emerges from the shadows with a wooden crate. He jumps down, sets it in front of the doorway, and gives it a loud pat. The doctor gazes upon it for a moment and then climbs up, clutching his black bag primly in front of him.
Where's the patient? He says, squinting and scanning the interior.
Over there, says Earl.
Camilla's huddled against a corner. Grady and Bill hover over him. The doctor walks over to them.
Some privacy, please, he says.
The other men scatter, murmuring in surprise. They move to the other end of the car and crane their necks, trying to see. The doctor approaches Camel and crouches beside him. Can't help noticing that he keeps the knees of his suit off the floorboards. A few minutes later, he straightens up and says,
Jamaica ginger paralysis, no question about it. I suck my breath in through my teeth.
What? What's that? Camel croaks.
You get it from drinking Jamaica ginger extract.
The doctor puts great emphasis on the final three words.
Or Jake, as it's commonly known.
But how? Why?
Says Camel, his eyes desperately seeking the doctor's face.
I don't understand. I've been drinking it for years.
Yes, yes, I would have guessed that, says the doctor. Anger rises like bile in my throat. I step up beside the doctor.
I don't believe you answered the question, I say as calmly as I can.
The doctor turns and surveys me through his pince-nez. After a pause of a few beats, he says,
It's caused by a Cresol compound used by a manufacturer.
Dear God, I say.
Quite.
Why did they add it? To get around the regulations that require that Jamaica ginger extract be rendered unpalatable. He turns back to Camel and raises his voice. So it won't be used as an alcoholic beverage.
Will it go away?
Camel's voice is high, cracking with fear.
No, I'm afraid not, the doctor says.
Behind me, the others catch their breath. Grady comes forward until we're touching shoulders.
Wait a minute, you mean there's nothing you can do?
The doctor straightens up and hooks his thumbs in his pockets.
Me?
No, absolutely not, he says. His expression is compressed as a pug's, as though he's trying to close his nostrils through facial muscles alone. He picks up his bag and edges toward the door.
Hold on just a cotton-picking moment, says Grady. If you can't do anything, is there anyone else who can?
The doctor turns to address me specifically, I suppose because I'm the one who paid him.
Oh, there's plenty who will take your money and offer a cure. Wading in oil slush pools, electrical shock therapy. But none of it does a lick of good. He may recover some function over time, but it will be minimal, at best. Really, he shouldn't have been drinking in the first place. It is against federal law, you know. I'm speechless. I think my mouth may actually be open.
Is that everything? He says.
I beg your pardon?
Do you need anything else? He says as though I'm an idiot.
No,
I say.
Then I'll bid you a good day.
He tips his hat, steps gingerly onto the crate, and dismounts. He walks a dozen yards away, sets his bag on the ground, and pulls a handkerchief from his pocket. He wipes his hands carefully, getting in between each finger. Then he picks up his bag, puffs out his chest, and walks off. Taking Camel's last scrap of hope in my father's pocket watch with him. When I turn back, Earl, Grady, and Bill are kneeling around Camel. Tears stream down the old man's face.
Walter, I need to talk to you, I say, bursting into the goat room. Queenie raises her head, sees that it's me, and sets it back on her paws.
Walter sets his book down.
Why, what's up?
I need to ask a favor.
Well, go on then, what is it?
A friend of mine is in a bad way.
That guy with Jake Leg?
I pause.
Yes.
I walk over to my bedroll, but I'm too anxious to sit down.
Well, spit it out then,
Walter says impatiently. I want to bring him here.
What? He's going to get red-lighted otherwise. His friends had to hide him behind a roll of canvas last night. Walter looks at me in horror. You have to be kidding.
Look, I know you were less than thrilled when I showed up, and I know he's a working man and all, but he's an old man, and he's in bad shape and needs help.
And what exactly are we supposed to do with him? Just keep him away from Blackie.
How long? Forever?
I dropped to the edge of my bedroll. He's right, of course. We can't keep Camel hidden forever. Shit, I say. I bang my forehead with the heel of my palm, and then again, and then again.
Hey, stop that, says Walter. He sits forward, closing his book. Those are serious questions. What would we do with him?
I don't know. Does he have any family? I look up at him suddenly. He mentioned a son once.
Okay. Well, now we're getting somewhere.
Do you know where this son is?
No. I gather they aren't in touch.
Walter stares at me, tapping his fingers against his leg. After half a minute of silence, he says,
All right. Bring him on over. Don't let anyone see you, or we'll all catch hell.
I look up in surprise.
What? He says, brushing a fly from his forehead.
Nothing.
No, actually, I mean, thank you. Very much.
Hey, I got a heart, he says, lying back and picking up his book. Not like some people we all know and love.
Walter and I are relaxing between the matinee and evening show when there's a soft rapping on our door.
He leaps up to his feet, knocking over the wooden crate and cursing as he keeps the kerosene lamp from hitting the floor.
I approach the door and glance nervously at the trunks laid end to end across the back wall.
Walter rights the lamp and gives me the briefest of nods. I open the door.
Marlena, I say, swinging the door farther open than I intend to. What are you doing up? I mean, are you okay? Do you want to sit down?
No, she says. Her face is inches from mine.
I'm all right, but I'd like to speak to you for a moment. Are you alone?
No, not exactly, I say, glancing back at Walter, who's shaking his head and waving his hands furiously.
Can you come to the stateroom?
Marlena says.
It won't take but a moment.
Yes, of course. She turns and walks gingerly to the doorway.
She's wearing slippers, not shoes.
She sits on the edge and eases herself down. I watch for a moment, relieved to see that while she moves carefully, she's not limping, obviously. I close the door.
Man, oh man, says Walter, shaking his head. I nearly had a heart attack. Shit, man, what the hell are we doing?
Hey, Camel, I say. You okay back there?
Yep,
says a thin voice from behind the trunks.
Reckon she saw anything?
No, you're in the clear. For now. But we're gonna have to be very careful. Marlena is in the plush chair with her legs crossed. When I first come in, she's sitting forward, rubbing the arch of one foot. When she sees me, she stops and leans back.
Jacob, thank you for coming.
Certainly, I say. I remove my hat and hold it awkwardly to my chest.
Please, sit down.
Thank you, I say, sitting on the edge of the nearest chair. I look around. Where's August?
He and Uncle Al are meeting with the railroad authority.
Oh, I say. Anything serious?
Just rumors. Someone reported that we were red-lighting men. They'll sort it out, I'm sure.
Rumors. Yes, I say. I hold my hat in my lap, fingering its edge and waiting.
So, I was worried about you, she says.
You were?
Are you all right?
She asks quietly.
Yes, of course, I say.
Then it dawns on me what she's asking.
Oh, God, no, it's not what you think. The doctor wasn't for me. I needed him to see a friend, and it wasn't for that. Oh, she says with a nervous laugh. I'm so glad. I'm sorry, Jacob. I didn't mean to embarrass you. I was just worried.
I'm fine, really.
And your friend?
I hold my breath for a moment. Not so fine.
Will she be okay? She, I look up, caught off guard. Marlena looks down, twisting her fingers in her lap.
I just assumed it was Barbara.
I cough and then I choke.
Oh, Jacob. Oh, goodness, I'm making an awful mess of this. It's none of my business, really. Please forgive me. No, I hardly know Barbara. I blush so hard my scalp prickles. It's all right, I know she's a...
Marlena twists her fingers awkwardly and lets the sentence go unfinished.
Well, despite that, she's not a bad sort. Quite decent, really. Although you want to...
Marlena, I say with enough force to stop her from talking. I clear my throat and continue. I'm not involved with Barbara. I hardly know her. I don't think we've exchanged more than a dozen words in our lives.
Oh, she says. It's just Augie said...
We sit in excruciating silence for nearly half a minute.
So your feet are better, then? I ask. Yes, thank you.
Her hands are clasped so tightly her knuckles are white. She swallows and looks at her lap.
There was something else I wanted to talk to you about. What happened in the alley in Chicago?
That was entirely my fault, I say quickly. I can't imagine what came over me. Temporary insanity or something. I'm so very sorry. I can assure you it will never happen again.
Oh, she says quietly.
I look up, startled. Unless I'm very much mistaken, I think I've just managed to offend her.
I'm not saying... It's not that you're not... I just... Are you saying you didn't want to kiss me?
I drop my head and raise my hands.
Marlena, please help me. I don't know what you want me to say. Because it would be easier if you didn't.
If I didn't what?
If you didn't want to kiss me, she says quietly. My jaw moves, but it's several seconds before anything comes out. Marlena, what are you saying? I'm not really sure, she says. I hardly know what to think anymore. I haven't been able to stop thinking about you. I know what I'm feeling is wrong, but I just... Well, I guess I just wondered.
When I look up, her face is cherry red. She's clasping and unclasping her hands, staring hard at her lap.
Marlena, I say, rising and taking a step forward. I think you should go now, she says.
I stare at her for a few seconds.
Please,
she says, without looking up.
And so I leave, although every bone in my body screams against it.
Chapter 15.
Camel spends his days hidden behind the trunks, lying on blankets that Walter and I arranged to cushion his ruined body from the floor. His paralysis is so bad I'm not sure he could crawl out even if he wanted to, but he's so terrified of being caught that he doesn't try. Each night after the train is in motion, we pull the trunks out and lean him up in the corner, or lay him on the cot, depending on whether he wants to sit up or continue lying down. It's Walter who insists he take the cot, and in turn, I insist that Walter take the bedroll. And so I'm back to sleeping on the horse blanket in the corner. Barely 2 days into our cohabitation, Camel's tremors are so bad he can't even speak. Walter notices at noon when he returns to the train to bring Camel some food. Camel is in such bad shape, Walter seeks me out in the menagerie to tell me about it. But August is watching, so I can't return to the train. At nearly midnight, Walter and I are sitting side by side on the cot, waiting for the train to pull out. The second it moves, we get up and drag the trunks from the wall. Walter kneels, puts his hands under Camel's armpits, and lifts him into a sitting position. Then he pulls a flask from his pocket. When Camel's eyes light on it, they jerk up to Walter's face. Then they fill with tears.
What's that? I ask quickly.
What the hell do you think it is? Walter says. It's liquor. Real liquor. The good stuff.
Camel reaches for the bottle with shaking hands. Walter, still holding him upright, removes the cap and holds it to the man's lips. Another week passes, and Marlena remains cloistered in her stateroom. I'm now so desperate to lay eyes on her that I find myself trying to figure out ways of peeking into the window without getting caught. Fortunately, good sense prevails.
Every night I lie on my smelly horse blanket in the corner and replay our last conversation, word for precious word. I follow the same tortured trajectory over and over, from my rush of disbelieving joy to my crashing deflation. I know that dismissing me was the only thing she could do, but even so, I can barely stand it. Just thinking about it leaves me so agitated I toss and writhe until Walter tells me to knock it off because I'm keeping him up. Onward and upward. Mostly we stay one day in each town, although we usually make a 2-day stopover Sunday. During the jump between Burlington and Keokuk, Walter, with the help of a generous amount of whiskey, manages to extract the name and last known location of Campbell's son. For the next few stops, Walter marches off to town immediately after breakfast and doesn't return until it's nearly showtime. By Springfield, he has made contact. At first, Campbell's son denies the association, but Walter is persistent. Day after day, he marches into town, negotiating by telegram, and by the following Friday, the son has agreed to meet us in Providence and take custody of the old man. It means we will have to continue the current housing arrangements for several more weeks, but at least it's a solution, and that's a good deal more than we've had up to this point. In Terre Haute, the lovely Lucinda drops dead. After Uncle Al recovers from his violent but short-lived bereavement, he organizes a farewell befitting our beloved Lucinda. An hour after the death certificate is signed, Lucinda is laid out in the water well of the hippopotamus car and hitched to a team of 24 black percherons with feathers on their headbands. Uncle Al climbs onto the bench with the driver, practically collapsing with grief. After a moment, he wiggles his fingers, signaling the start of Lucinda's procession. She is hauled slowly through town, followed on foot by every member of the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on earth deemed fit to be seen. Uncle Al is desolate, weeping and honking into his red handkerchief, and allowing himself only the occasional upward glance to gauge whether the procession's speed allows for maximum crowd enlargement. The women follow immediately behind the hippopotamus wagon, dressed all in black, and pressing elegant lace hankies to the corners of their eyes. I am farther back, surrounded on all sides by wailing men, their faces shiny with tears. Uncle Al has promised $3 and a bottle of Canadian whiskey to the man who puts on the best show. You've never seen such grief. Even the dogs are howling. Almost 1,000 townspeople follow us back to the lot. When Uncle Al stands up on the carriage, they fall silent. He removes his hat and presses it to his chest. He digs out a hanky and dabs his eyes. He delivers a heart-wrenching speech so distraught he can barely contain himself. At the end of it, he says that if it were up to him, he'd cancel tonight's show out of respect for Lucinda. But he cannot. It's out of his control. He is a man of honor, and on her deathbed she grasped his hand and made him promise, no, vow, that he wouldn't let what was clearly her imminent end disrupt the show's routine and disappoint the thousands of people who were expecting it to be circus day.
Because after all,
Uncle Al pauses, clasping his hand to his heart and sniffing piteously. He looks heavenward as tears stream down his face. The women and children in the crowd cry openly. A woman near the front throws an arm across her forehead and collapses as the men on either side scramble to catch her. Uncle Al collects himself with obvious effort, although he cannot keep his lower lip from quivering. He nods slowly and continues.
Because, after all, as our dearest Lucinda knew only too well, the show must go on.
We have an enormous crowd that night, a straw house, so named because after all the regular seats sell out, roustabouts spread straw on the hippodrome track for the overflow crowd to sit on. Uncle Al begins the show with a moment of silence. He bows his head, summons real tears, and dedicates the performance to Lucinda.
whose great and absolute selflessness is the only reason we were able to continue in the face of our loss. And we will do her proud. Oh, yes, such was our singular love for Lucinda, that despite the grief that consumes us, tugging on our breaking hearts, we will summon the strength to honor her final wish and do her proud. Such wonders you have never seen, ladies and gentlemen. Acts and performers gathered from the four corners of the earth to delight and entertain you. Acrobats and tumblers and aerialists of the highest caliber.
The show is about a quarter of the way through when she walks into the menagerie. I sense her presence even before I hear the surprised murmurs around me. I set Bobo on the floor of his den. I turn, and sure enough, there she is, gorgeous in pink sequins and feathered headdress, removing her horse's halters and letting them drop to the ground. Only Boaz, a Black Arabian and presumably Silver Star's counterpart, remains tethered, and he's clearly unhappy about it. I lean against Bobo's den, mesmerized. Those horses, with whom I've spent every night riding from town to town to town, and who normally look like regular horses, have transformed. They blow and snort, their necks arched and tails aloft. They gather into two dancing groups, one black, one white. Marlena faces them, carrying a long whip in each hand. She raises one and waves it over her head. Then she walks backward, leading them from the menagerie. The horses are completely free. They wear no halters, no side reins, no surcingles, nothing. They simply follow her, shaking their heads and flinging their legs forward like saddlebreds. I've never seen her act. Those of us who work behind the scenes don't have time for that luxury. But this time nothing could stop me. I secure Bobo's door and slip into the connection, the roofless canvas tunnel that joins the menagerie to the big top. The reserved seat ticket seller glances at me quickly, and when he realizes I'm not a cop, goes back to his business. His pockets jingle, swollen with money. I stand beside him, looking across the three rings to the back end of the big top. Uncle Al announces her, and she steps inside. She spins, holding both whips high in the air. She flicks one and takes a few steps backward. The two groups of horses hurry in behind her. Marlena sashays to the center ring and they follow, high-kicking, prancing clouds of black and white. Once she's in the center of the ring, she slaps the air lightly. The horses start circling the ring at a trot, five white followed by five black. After two complete rotations, she wiggles the whip. The black horses speed up until each is trotting beside a white horse. Another wiggle, and they ease into line so that the horses are now alternating black and white. She moves only minimally, her pink sequins shimmering under the bright lights. She walks a small circle in the center of the ring, flicking the whips in combinations of signals. The horses continue circling, with the white horses passing the black horses and then the black horses passing the white horses, with the end result always being alternating colors. She calls out and they stop. She says something else, and they turn and step up so their front hooves are on the ring curb. They walk sideways, their tails toward Marlena, and their hooves up on the rim. They do an entire rotation before she stops them again. They climb down and swing around to face her. Then she calls forth Midnight. He is a magnificent black all-Arabian fire with a perfect white diamond on his forehead. She speaks to him, taking both whips in one hand and offering him her other palm. He presses his muzzle into it, his neck arched and nostrils flared. Marlena steps backward and raises a whip. The other horses watch, dancing on the spot. She lifts the other whip and flicks its tip back and forth. Midnight rises up on his hind legs, his forelegs curled in front of him. She shouts something now, the first time she's raised her voice, and strides backward. The horse follows, walking on his hind legs and pawing the air in front of him. She keeps him upright all the way around the ring. Then she motions him down. Another cryptic circling of the whip.
and Midnight bows, going down on the knee of one foreleg with the other extended. Marlena drops into a low curtsy, and the crowd goes wild. With Midnight still bowing, she lifts both whips and then flicks them. The rest of the horses